care about the person itself, and they're so money hungry that they feel that if a status Indian or a non-status woman gets back on the reserve, that they're going to take up all the land, they're going to eat up all the food, and they're going to do this and they're going to do that.
I think that's, I was asked that question. They says, who's more prejudiced? They asked me that. Who's more prejudiced when it comes down to that? Because we're going through that right now. And some of the opinions of our council members drive me right up the wall. As I said, like, I figure that a lot of people ain't going to stand for it, though, because I said there's a lot of people out there that are related to the people that are Bill C-31 people and stuff like that. I says, and I don't think that, you know, it's going to work very long. But they should get used to it. Well, it's something they got to get used to,
I guess. But if they want self-government, right? If they want self-government, the first self-government is here. It's bringing back the people to their reserves. It's bringing them back to their culture. It's bringing them back to their traditional ways. And if they don't do that, why even ask for self-government? If they can't even bring back their own people, why ask for self-government?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's useless to them. And you try to tell them that. That's why they're not getting it in right now, is because of the fact there's so many different things. They want to go ahead, but they can't go ahead till this.
I figure that they are going to go ahead, but I figure that it's going to be the younger generation that is going to do it. Now, I don't figure, like, to me, I think that there is going to be self-government for the Indians, but not in this generation. I think it's going to be not in my daughter's generation, but in her children's generation. That's when I think it'll be. What's that, the second generation from now? That's when I think it'll be.
Because it wouldn't be in my generation, and it won't be in my son's, but my son's. So that's about the fourth generation. My mom's the first, I'm the second, my son's the third, and then his kids would be the fourth. So it would be generation, which in turn says that it is the fourth generation that will make a major decision in life.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the seventh generation, which we are now, that will change their decision to whether they go self-government or to whether they stay where they are.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about what they would decide? Like, how would you try to change that?
Regarding self-government or?
Well, in order to answer the question Betsy had.
Well, the self-government, wouldn't it like sort of bring the Indian people closer together? Because they would all have to work with each other. They would all have to, you know, in order for this to work. The way I see things now, a lot of tribes are against each other. I've been to a lot of meetings, and I see these ones in Brantford, Six Nations. They have a lot of problems there. We have problems down here because there's three reserves here. Moravian Town is more, I don't know how you'd say it. They've got more culture, more within their own people. Like now, they're not so advanced as the ones down further south, down this way.
I think a lot of it has to do with the TV, the radio, the medium, the people that they surround themselves with. But what I'm saying about self-government is, in order to have self-government, they have to start first bringing back their own people, and then start building on the self-government.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would see self-government. Personally, right now, no, I wouldn't see it.
No, I don't get it.
It isn't because I'm a non-status, it's just the fact that there's people out there, and they want to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And in the days, maybe a long time ago.
You know, there's a lot of people out there that don't want to come back.
Mm-hmm.
Believe
and
it
that's
too.
Just because they're made to feel like they've been out of place.
Mm-hmm.
Like my mom said.
I think if I didn't move back when I did move back, I probably wouldn't have come back either. Because I would have been too.
What made you come back? What made you come back here? Is there something?
I don't know. I guess it was because I was born down here. And we did live down here for... And I didn't really like the city life. It was too fast to... you couldn't really enjoy the open space, the quietness. Like now you can for a while, you know. But in the city there was always so much noise, and it always seemed like, you know, everybody seemed to move at such a fast pace all the time. Everybody was always in a hurry. Nobody had any time to stand still, it seemed like, when we were in a city. Because if you weren't getting pushed here, pushed there, the sales are the worst. I never seen people act as I seen when I go to a sale. I just stand there and look at them and just wonder, what, you know, what's happening here for people to act like that. I think that's why I come back out, because it's not so rushed and not so, you can enjoy. There seems to be peace or something. I don't know what it is.
Let's go back to the books again. You read the books about Native culture written by non-whites.
Non-natives, yeah.
I'm sorry, non-natives. What was it that was missing from them for you?
I think it was because it wasn't coming from the grassroots. Like, it wasn't... I feel that Indian people would be able to say it better or describe things the way things real are real, like to Indian people. When a non-native does it, I think it's just, you know, they're not covering the real thing. They're missing. It seems like there's something missing there. They're not. The natives would really know what long time back from being passed on and being passed on. They would know more than the non-native would, because they don't live in that environment. They've never lived in the environment. And they wouldn't be able to really say what a native would say. When I did read it a lot of times, I did feel that, like, as a native, when I was reading it, I could tell that it wasn't, some of it was their own words. And some of the things that they, like what she was telling me, I didn't know that stone, the beads were made out of stones before. I never read that in the book. When it was in the book, they said it was just beads. Okay, where did these beads come from? I didn't even think about that. And that's what I mean. If a native wrote it themselves, that's the only way I think that you would be able to preserve the cultures, the native people.
One of the things that, as Carolyn and I have worked together, is that there are two. Oftentimes there are questions that she would ask that I wouldn't ask. I'm on the outside looking in, so I have a certain kind of question that I would ask. But there are certain things that it wouldn't even occur to me to ask. That because I haven't lived on a reserve, because I haven't been a part of the day-to-day life,
mm-hmm.
there are the subtle things that are even
mm-hmm.
more important.
Okay, like even if your grandfather, like, my grandfather was deaf, but he was smart, and he was deaf ever since he was 21 years old. He never had hearing aid or anything, but I never thought about, like, when he was younger, and I was younger, and I talked to him, and he could answer me. I never really realized he was deaf until I got a little older. And then I start thinking to myself, how does he know so much? And he can't even hear. But you know, he would read everything in sight too.
He listens to his heart, and he gets it through.
And he would be the only one that would go hunting. Like, I didn't know either in them days. Like I didn't know this. When you go hunting for a deer, he says, the way that you don't, so that the deer can't smell the human, he made a fire and he stood in the smoke. And he stood in the smoke for about an hour, and then he went out into the bush and he got a deer. Now, I've never seen none of these fellas nowadays do that. They go hunting with a light and, you know, but my grandfather never did that.
My grandfather used to just look. He said if he could see two eyes in the trees, it would be like a maze. And if you look at a tree long enough, you'll notice two little round eyes, and you'll know that's the deer. And that's how he hunted.
Mm-hmm.
And the funny thing was, my grandfather was white. And
yeah.
Yet he knew about the medicine.
Mm-hmm.
He helped my grandmother out a lot with medicine. He taught her everything he knew. He taught the Indians on the reserve how to plow and everything. And yet he was more Indian than he was white.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, they ended up classifying him as Indian. But it took him a long time to get that far. You know, it was maybe about 5 years before he died that they finally accepted him as being Indian and not white.
Mm-hmm.
What other things do you feel that Indian people have to do for themselves to hold on to their ways?
Well, the ones, I guess, that are growing up now, they gotta, if it's really not taught in school, a lot of things, I think it has to be taught at home. I tried, like I don't know that much, but I try to tell my children what I do know now, so that they can tell theirs. But yes? And don't phone me in here again, I'm in an interview. Okay. Oh, where
is it? So you're saying you try to tell your...
Yeah, that's the only way that I think it can be done, like a bit, other than education purposes. Okay. Oh, Michelle?
Come in.
Come in. Oh, is that door locked?
I don't know.
Maybe
it looks
not.
Like it is.
I'm going to have you back up again, because I'm not sure if you got interrupted in that, because that was a really important thing that you said. Tell me again about how you think this information will be passed on to the next generation, what you do.
Oh,
that
if you tell, yeah, like I think that what every home should do though anyways is tell their younger children what they know now. Like a lot of them too will say that my grandfather, my grandmother said. And when you tell it to your younger ones and then they tell it, I tell my children that now. Anything that you know about your culture, anything that you learn, don't be afraid to tell your children, and tell your children to tell theirs. I said, that's the only way that we're going to be able to keep our culture alive, because so much of it is going away in a lot of ways. I don't know whether it's because we don't have the same things that we used to work with.
Right.
When, say, about 75 years ago, when they did beadwork, how did they do it?
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays they use looms. I don't know if they ever used a loom.
They used a loom, but what it was wooden. It was made out of wood, like just branches. And they used sinew, the sinew of the... whatever
the animal?
The animal, they used the sinew of the animal, and they wove that.
even the colors, you say, are different. Because they never had that many.
Well, the colors were made from berries or bark or from the ground.
I remember, yeah, I think my father told me that once, mm-hmm. that's what they used to use.
Mm-hmm. And the ash will make colors. Your cigarette ash will make colors.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Make colors. It will make a brown color, a reddish brown.
Mm-hmm.
So you can tell.
I noticed too, like Bill Dawson. He used to be the chief down here, it must be 30, 40 years ago. So he's got to be into his 90s now. I think you may have seen him in a newspaper, William B. Dawson.
Mm-hmm.
When we were first doing beadwork, my daughter seen him with a lot of beads, seen his costume. And she just went out and started asking him questions herself. And it made me feel really proud that, you know, that she is interested and really would like to know too. She wanted to know the color of the beads, she wanted to know their meanings, and he explained it to her. They talked for about 2 hours, I think, that day. And she talked to him. So that's what I... Like, if you teach your kids, children that, and you keep... And they learn it, and then they'll learn theirs.
It's just like the outfits today. They're made, they're cut even and straight. In those days, put through, and then you just tie them, and that's the way it was. And if they put beads on them,
mm-hmm.
it was just the shiny stone beads. Any kind of necklaces was made from the teeth or the fingernails, the teeth, mm-hmm. the bones,
mm-hmm.
anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, today the outfits that are being done today, they're all just done like they're cut out nice and even. It's not like what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, like, too, I think a lot of it has to do with showing now, because it's this time of the century, maybe it's time for that change, and this
mm-hmm.
is what's happening. It's gradually changing, maybe in the years to come.
But
different.
There is, I think, some of them outfits that they have, some of them are so beautiful.
It's the pride that's still there,
regardless yeah.
of whether the style
mm-hmm.
changes. One of the things that, did I ever show you that necklace I brought back from Africa, the beaded necklace?
Mm-hmm.
I think I did, it was a red and black one. What was interesting was that the African tribes in East Africa do beadwork that is not unlike beadwork that Native people do here. As far as the necklaces are great big collars that go around. And they didn't use beads either until Europeans came, and they got all their beads from Czechoslovakia, glass beads originally.
Mm-hmm.
And they took, again, they made the same change that Native people did here in Canada and the United States, from using bones and shells and teeth and that kind of thing to using these beads.
Mm-hmm.
The designs were the same, and what they did with the beads was so different than anything that had ever been done in Europe. That even though they were using European materials, it was theirs. They
mm-hmm.
made it theirs.
Mm-hmm.
They did with it. Beautiful.
Can you imagine if those beads were around in them days?
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When we were talking the last time, one of the issues for you was getting materials.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Oh, okay. I want to make a dress for my granddaughter. And I've got to go about a good 100 miles, maybe further, to get these. And that's going to cost a lot of money, just to make one dress.
What kinds of materials do you need for the dress?
I wanted to get white leather.
For your grandmother?
Because she's a baby.
Yeah.
Did they make costumes out of white leather before for babies? Or did they just make them with the... those things that they carry them in? The, I don't know what you call those.
Cradle board.
Yeah.
Well, they have... I don't know if it's down here or out in the States. White leathers or white hide is not used very often unless it's for two people coming together.
Oh.
Or the birth of the child. The Mogsons have a meaning to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the white is a purifying meaning. It has like a... It would depend on the person that's giving it to that person, what they decide. But if you're going to use white, use a white doeskin, don't use white leather.
Doeskin?
Yeah, leather will burn your baby.
Oh.
Burn the skin of the baby because the sweat and the leather, the chemicals that they use.
Oh, that must be what it is then, doeskin, what I'm looking for.
So it's like a white doeskin. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I want.
It's like a chamois.
Yeah.
Put on it like a white doeskin chamois. They use that. How old is the baby?
By the time the powwow comes around, she should be 8 months.
Get a chamois would be a lot better for her than them. The doeskin, you'd be having to clean it quite a bit, so a chamois would be a lot easier for you to use. And a chamois, I think you can get them around town. If you're lucky, go to any leather store. I might have that white chamois. I don't let them do that. Because a chamois is a very soft and easy and flexible material to work with. If you're going to put her in white, put her all in white.
The moccasin. And when I was making my grandson his costume, I wanted all leather. I wanted deer skin for him because I made his costume different. Like it doesn't cover the full body. He can wear something in under it. And I couldn't find what I wanted was deer hide. That's what I wanted.
Deer hide and doe skin is the same thing.
But I couldn't get it anywhere. Tandy's had all kinds of leather, but none of it was deer hide leather. And that's what I wanted, and I couldn't get it.
And go to Doug McMillan's on Dundas, across from Kellogg's. There's it's called McMillan's Leather and Craft Store. He's got doeskin there, but he charges a lot.
Yeah, that's the other problem, is
but
the cost of things. When you do want something, the cost of it is ridiculous sometimes.
But the most with that is, it's $40 a hide. Now, if you're going to buy one, make sure you get the biggest one, because one big one should do your granddaughter.
Mm-hmm.
But if you get a small one, you're going to have to get two, and that's going to cost you $80.
Mm-hmm.
If you when you're picking out your doeskin, make sure there's no little cracks in the back, too many little cracks, and you'll find that on your doeskin there's pieces where it's very, very thin. Don't get that. Always get something that looks nice and even. Flip it over on the other side and make sure it's the same way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, these places, they have, there's one in Brantford, there's one in Wapool, I know. The one in Brantford, they just sell beads.
Six Nations? Mm-mm, she's got a lot of doeskin there.
Does she?
Mm-hmm.
This
Mary Hills?
Yeah, this was in, this, lately or always?
She's always had doeskin, she usually has them piled up there.
Oh, because when I went there, all I seen was mostly beads.
No, doeskin. She's got doeskin there.
Oh, I could have got some then.
Yeah.